This is Screen Divers. On this week's episode, we are talking about 1986 classic Platoon, directed by Oliver Stone, written by Oliver Stone, produced by Arnold Copleson, and starring Charlie Sheen, Tom Berenger, Willem Dafoe, Keith David, Forest Whitaker, Francesco Quinn, Kevin Dillon, running out of breath, Corey Glover, Johnny Depp. There's a huge, huge cast here. Cinematography by Robert Richardson, edited by Claire Simpson. Music by Georges Delerue, although that's not really important because you're going to remember one piece of music running through this movie.
Yes.
Distributed by Orion Pictures. And this movie has a running time of 120 minutes that paces furiously. This movie was made for $6 million.
Yeah.
Which is unbelievable by any standard. It made $138.5 million, and it won a ton of accolades. How are you, Ricky?
I'm great after this film. How are you?
I'm all right, man. I'm all right. I'm getting older. It's my birthday tomorrow.
Yeah, and it's my birthday on Tuesday.
I know.
So join the club. Getting older. We're both May birthdays. I get it.
You'll still never be as old as me.
Yeah, I know. Can you sound a little bit more like Alec Guinness, please? Just a little, a touch more.
Use the force, Luke.
Oh, my God. Okay. How are you, Steve?
I'm good. I can't wait to start celebrating your birthday weekend a little bit later today. Mm-hmm. But yeah.
You're going to have to change your name tomorrow.
Nope.
And we have a special guest today, Mr. Jeff Walker!
Woo!
Jesus Christ, Jeff, a little bit more excitement. Just a touch.
I can tell you there's a 80% chance that there's going to be banging on my office door at some point because my kids are up and they are ornery. So
yeah, but you only have a couple of kids, right?
No, I got six, so I'm doing that.
We knew the answer to that.
Yeah, is that your way of goading that out of me?
No, not at all, not at all, man. I bought a larger television before you ever did. Now, Jeff, I met Jeff digitally. He's like a pen pal, a modern pen pal. I met him on the Friends of Horror Weekly, led by the immortal George with the sweetest voice in the universe. If you don't know what we're talking about, you should get your shit together. There's a podcast that is way better than this, with a host that is way better than us. The name of the show in question is Horror Weekly. There's a very, very avid and frenzied community attached to this group. We are members of that community, and let's see, just go check it out, Horror Weekly, really.
Yeah, I think we're like shit-posting pen pals, basically. So.
Yeah, that's what we are.
Oh, you'll fit straight in, man.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Usually when you send me something to you, it's like, I think we follow like the same, like,
whatever. The algorithm is like, sinking now. It's beginning to sink.
Yeah, it's like, you'll send me something, and I'll be like, yeah, I saw that like 2 days ago.
Yeah. A quintessential question must be asked. Ricky, what's this movie about?
We're in the trenches of Vietnam, and man, it's an awful, awful, awful time to be there.
That's true.
It's about war. And what is war good for?
Absolutely nothing. I thought you were going to say war never changes.
And it's such a weird juxtaposition because we've just watched a film. We've just done a review of a film that actually said war is terrific. Oh my God. No, just take it off the screen.
It took Anna yesterday to say to me, are you guys following some kind of trail or, you know, is there some, so why? No, of course not. She goes, you've done a lot of Nicolas Cage and Charlie Sheen movies. I'm like, yeah, we have.
Yeah.
And I didn't have any other answer other than, well, they made a lot of movies. They were everywhere in the 80s and the 90s. That's why they're huge stars.
Yeah.
But I think it's just a coincidence. We're not following any. But it is weird. It is weird now. It's getting weird. It's like John Lovitz, Charlie Sheen, and Nicolas Cage.
Did you guys have a hard time like seeing Charlie Sheen after watching Hot Shots and like taking him seriously?
Oh yes. we maybe
okay.
Just a little bit.
I did.
There's a shot in particular where I ejected because it took me right out. But we talk about towards the end, and we talk about this later. Who picked this movie?
You did.
You.
Okay.
Yeah.
Whoa. What's the problem with this movie, Ricky? I don't understand. No, it's a great movie.
Okay, I'll give you, like, look.
Okay.
I'm going to find it very hard to talk and review this movie in the same levity and light that we normally look at movies. This, right. I'm not saying anything bad about this movie. This is, should be a viewed movie by everybody above 18 mm. upwards. This is definitely should be given to teenagers or people just starting, you know, university age and just being given and said, shut up and watch this and don't look at your phone. But, for example, I've got a feeling James Spader isn't on holiday this week. I've got he's on holiday this week. I am not contacting him. I am not getting him on the blower. He is not turning up today. And I just feel like there is so much in this movie that you kind of almost have to have a slight historical look at everything. Like, not only movies, but the times, the way this movie got put together, the history that Oliver Stone went through prior to making this movie. It's just, it's a big task today.
Yes, I wanted to touch on that as well, because when we look at this, he is a Vietnam vet.
But can I tell you that I didn't ever realize how much of an Hunter S. Thompson this is on a take.
Yeah.
Because he didn't have to do this. Like, the character that's played by Charlie Sheen, he wasn't really, didn't grow up poor or anything. He just wanted a different experience. And it's commendable because it's inspiring. But at the same time, I really enjoyed seeing Oliver Stone being blown up in a sequence, because I've completely forgot that happens in this movie.
Yeah.
And as that's happening on the screen, I'm actually reading about his felony in 1999 when he got caught drink driving on drugs. I think it's just what happens. It should be like a drug advert, like, don't do drugs, and then poof, just.
Okay, so have that in your head, but then also remember that when the village scene happened, he had a moment of PTSD the advisor, the technical advisor, had to basically take him aside and talk him down.
That technical advisor is also an actor in this movie.
Yeah.
Who?
Yeah.
Dale. He plays the...
No, say it at the same time, please, because this is going to be a fucking nightmare.
Three, two, one. Dale Dye.
Dale Dye.
No, we missed it all. But he plays Captain Harris. You know, towards the end, the massive crescendo of this film, there's a captain who's always on the phone, who isn't Oliver Stone. So Oliver Stone is one of the captains who is always on the phone. But Dale Dye
is the advisor. That guy's
the advisor.
He is the advisor. He's a good actor.
But yeah.
And not only that, he was the guy who put all the actors through boot camp.
And
he's the technical advisor. He did like Band of Brothers. He's the guy that like the Hollywood goes to for like, hey, we need to make our actors go through like some sort of boot camp. And he's also he's like a technical advisor. But he's had his hands in a lot of stuff.
What's his name
again?
Like
Band of Brothers.
Dale Dye. Okay, so it's not just that. He actually is the gunner in the aircraft in the closing scenes as well.
Yeah.
But he remembered at the last moment to pull down his visor so he wouldn't get seen.
Yeah, so you wouldn't be like, why is Captain Harris the gunner?
No, so he wouldn't pull a fit like fucking, what's his name, in The Mandalorian.
Oh, yeah. That's
they almost
true.
Got fired because he insisted he wanted to take his helmet off. Pedro Pascal.
Yeah.
Anyway, this is a very simple movie. It's a simple movie about a very complex war. And I actually enjoy the simplicity of this movie. There's a first act, there's a second act, and there's a third act.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And the middle section of this movie is bang on in the middle. Like, there's the catalyst for the story, the conflict between Elias and Barnes, which, by the way, guys, I'm a huge Punisher fan, and there's a part of me that he would have been perfect. Tom Berenger would have been perfect to play Jigsaw. Jigsaw, dude. But he's such a... It's fucking hypnotic in this, man.
Yeah.
He's so good in this. I forgot. Like, what was the name where he plays a, when Tom Berenger plays Jeff? Do you remember the movie where he plays a substitute teacher?
Mm-mm.
No? Anyone here? Like,
was that Big Chill or something like that?
Isn't it The Substitute?
What are you...
Isn't it just called The Substitute?
I can't remember.
So. I'll have a look at it now, but I swear it's just called The Substitute.
I think that's, yeah.
I can't remember.
I did that the other day in a shop. I needed help. I went, do you know where the... And the guy just turns around and points. It's right next to me on a shelf. I felt super stupid. Anyway.
Yeah, it's called The Substitute.
The Substitute. Okay. Well, there you go. Do you remember Berenger from anything else? Anyone here?
He was also in Training Day. He wasn't like
a Training Day, yeah.
And also, he then became a favorite of Oliver Stone. So there's a lot of Oliver Stone movies where he plays smaller roles, but yeah.
Yeah, but I'm talking about like a semi lead or a leading role. And does anyone remember Berenger?
Oh my God.
He's always kind of been the guy that is like a good character actor. I mean, it's like a leading guy.
So character actor 101.
Would you call him a leading role in this film? I know he's one of the main players, but would you call him a leading role?
I would say it's a leading role.
He was nominated for best supporting.
Yeah, but it feels like his performance feels like, you know, it's a central member of the cast. Like, but they all are, man. Like, all of them are.
It's basically William Dafoe and Tom Berenger were up for the same award, wasn't it?
I think that neither one of them got it, so they canceled each other out.
Yeah. Who got it? Who got it, Jeff?
I don't know. I don't remember. I just know that they were both nominated and neither one of them won.
Yeah. I really, really, because this was the same year as, what was the film I sent you? This was the same year as...
The one with William Hurt.
Yeah, I really hope it was William Hurt abusing Mary Matlin.
Yeah.
That film was called.
Tell Jeff. He doesn't know. What's the name of the movie?
I've got to look it up now because I sent it to you.
You sent it to me yesterday.
Oh, I know. I've had a lot go on today, all right? Just leave me alone.
Let me be.
Oh, my goodness. Did I send it to you or did I send it to the group?
You sent it to me, dude.
This is great. Oh, no. I sent it to the group. I was just on it.
I'm in there.
It was... Children of a Lesser God, and that won Mary Matlin the Best Actress award at the Oscars.
Jeff, do you watch Seinfeld? Are you a Seinfeld fan at all?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, well, do you remember the lip reader episode? There's an episode where...
Lip reader.
Yeah, Jerry and George seek the assistance of a lip reader, and it's this deaf woman that they meet at a tennis game. Well... That actress, the actress that plays that character, is a very famous deaf actress, and she's the female lead in the movie in question.
Yeah.
Interesting.
So, yeah.
And in it, there's a scene in the trailer where William Hurt turns around to her and said, "You're going to stop using your hands and use your words." And it's just like, whoa.
It's not just that. In the trailer, he goes to her and he's pointing at her chest aggressively. He goes, "I love you. I love you." It's really intense.
So bad. And then the end of the trailer is there,
all
like
right,
the end of the trailer is them making love in a swimming pool, and it's like, whoa, where did that come from?
Showgirls. That's Showgirls. Where that came from. Whenever someone says Jesus. Making love in a swimming pool or a pool or whatever, it's Showgirls.
Yeah. Like
should we go back to this movie? What do you think?
Yeah, sure. One.
Yeah. Okay. I wanted to bring up a little bit of a tidbit on this one. Because
you're just going
to
throw factoids randomly. Yeah, John Polito. Okay, go.
Yes.
Yes, please.
No, when Oliver Stone was originally wrote a script in 1971, he sent it to Jim Morrison, and he really wanted Jim Morrison to be play Chris.
That fucked it didn't happen.
He wants to be Topper Harley. What?
Yeah.
Oh, but, wrong movie. Sorry.
But the weird thing is, ultimately, when Morrison was found dead, he was found with the script.
This is the end, beautiful friend.
On him. like yeah. sat on
You're joking.
Yeah.
Oh, Oliver Stone killed
Jim.
With an early draft platoon.
Yeah, the first draft.
It was like six pages.
It's crazy.
The first 6 pages all about Native American Indians for no reason whatsoever. Stone puts that shit everywhere. It's true, man. It's true. Before we talk about this film, I had to look at this yesterday. I probably have and it's like written in stone. There's nothing you can say is going to change my opinion. I'm pretty sure you feel this. Giggity guru. Holy shit, man. All right. Pun not intended. But and I think I have three favorite Oliver Stone movies. And I think I was talking about this with Ricky until I went, we can't have this conversation now. I'll tell you mine. I just want you to give me your three because you won't have to think hard, I think. So Talk Radio, Platoon, and U-Turn.
Okay.
Who wants to go next?
And we've had this conversation and I kind of said to you, U-Turn.
Hey.
But anyway,
yeah.
I agree with you with Talk Radio. Mm-hmm. I agree with you with Platoon.
Mm-hmm.
His third, there's a lot of Oliver Stone I don't get on with. There's just so much that I don't get on with him.
Yeah, you made it clear when I told you we were talking about this movie.
I will probably say Wall Street.
My pick. Wall Street is one of my top three. I know this is going to be a bit of a problem one because I watched this film recently and I have to kind of take it back. Natural Born Killers.
I know. I watched.
I can't believe Umber and I had the same reaction.
Oh, I know.
Have you seen it?
I saw it.
I loved it in the '90s.
Yeah, I know.
Mate, you have no shame, dude. Have zero shame.
I have. This is why I'm admitting this.
Jeff had to change one of his picks. I think. I can see his body language.
So
I actually agree with you on that.
Okay. Finish up, Steve. I guess to go.
No, I just wanted to. I haven't said the last one, which is Platoon, but I wanted to say that Natural Born Killers was up there really high until I rewatched it recently. That's what I was trying to get to.
A damn shame, dude. It even marred the memory of that L7 sequence. Because you know what I mean? I can watch it until that point and then I have to switch it off. It's
that memory of seeing that
doing?
Movie in the cinema when it was released in 1994 blew me away. We thought it was great.
Oh, yeah. It's so fucking edgy.
I watched it last year and I had to basically turn around and go, no, it's not my favorite.
Do you know how many people are going to listen to this and they're going to go, oh, you guys are fucking wrong. They're going to rewatch
it. No, you're going to go watch it and you're just going to go, oh my
God. We're
going to
get emails, we're going to get messages going, you're right,
Anyway.
Jeff.
I got a Dark Horse one, actually, because I like any given song.
Yeah. Oh,
yeah, okay.
That would have been my number four.
Yeah, I'd say
Platoon. Natural Born Killers and Any Given Sunday. I feel like it's one of the better sports movies out there.
Mm.
Yeah. Like a good sports film. So
what is it? What is it? Are you keeping Natural Born Killers in your picks?
Yeah, so Platoon, Natural Born Killers, and Any Given Sunday.
I'm not going to ask you to defend Natural Born Killers. We're not going to do that now, but go ahead.
I think for me, the reason why I drop Natural Born Killers like a hot potato.
That was a top spot for me with The Doors, dude, years ago.
The Doors was great as well. But again, it's this whole rewriting of history stuff.
This is
why JFK will never be the top five for me of Oliver Stone movies.
Yeah.
Because he just, it doesn't serve my story. Oh, it doesn't matter. Let's just do whatever. But one of the reasons I dropped Natural Born Killers like a hot potato is just the treatment of some of the, I'm going to say, cameo actors in it.
One of them is
Robert Downey Jr. playing the fucking.
Oh, but him playing Australian, that was awful. Full stop. But I was saying the dad, I forgot Rodney Dangerfield. His treatment of that in that film is horrible, and it's like, how dare you, Rodney? It's Rodney Dangerfield. Like, he doesn't get enough respect, but it's Rodney Dangerfield, man, and he's just like being
Tom Sizemore. How about Tom Sizemore? Mm. Isn't Tom Sizemore in that as well? Or am I going crazy?
Yes, no, Tom Sizemore is a
super underrated actor. It's a shame. It's a damn shame.
We've got to remember, this is Oliver Stone. And Oliver Stone wants to put people in uncomfortable positions to get a better movie. This is it.
Well, actually, that's a mark of a good director.
Yeah, and this is what he did with this movie as well, Platoon. Mm. I'm just going to say that because he put people into boot camp purely to basically not take him through training.
He's not the first one to do it, mate. Kubrick did it.
Yeah, I know.
Kubrick actually... No, here's the fun thing about this movie. This movie started production after Full Metal Jacket, which is hilarious because some producer out there was like, oh, Full Metal Jacket is actually going on, and it's going on... It's being filmed in similar areas as... for the Vietnam sequence. But you know what? We're going to slip in this movie... put less of a budget, and we know that this director and writer is going to spend less time than Kubrick, because Kubrick's going to take a forever to release.
Donkey's years.
So the fact that this movie was made in the middle of Full Metal Jacket is hilarious, that some producer out there was like, oh, yeah, there's another Vietnam. It doesn't matter. It's Kubrick. We can push out another one before he gets his out. So,
look, the Full Metal Jacket is also, I mean, this is a personal opinion, but I think it's a whole other level.
Mm.
You know, like I actually put this, and that's not a bad thing, but I do put Platoon in the same draw. And that's, again, not a bad thing. As Casualties of War, Hamburger Hill.
Oh.
I don't know, Jeff. You see where I'm going with this? You've seen those other two movies, right?
Yeah. I have strong opinions on Full Metal Jacket as far as the first half versus the second half.
Everybody.
The first half is like, you know, 5 out of 5, and then the second half I think takes like a pretty sharp nosedive after boot camp. So I feel like the war portions of it aren't nearly as good.
I agree with you, and did with me for many years. But then I rewatched it recently, and I started to appreciate the second part as well. It's just that they might as well be two different movies. That's the issue. There's like a strong divide.
Yeah. And
in fact, but Kubrick wasn't an idiot. That divide, I went to see it in a theater, and I remember that was still the time for intermission.
Yeah. The intermission is in the middle. Yeah.
Yeah, so you walked into a second movie. And he did the same with 2001. If you get the latest, like, you have no idea how much I miss intermission. It was an amazing thing. You could go outside to have a smoke for 10, 15 minutes, and all of a sudden you were talking with a stranger about the movie. You know, you would, there's murmurs everywhere, and there would be this electricity in the air if the movie was good. It was a thing. It was a fucking thing, and they took it away.
I can see it making dates a lot better, because that's why movies suck as like a date ID.
I used to get late much more, and it's not because I was younger. No, dude, that was definitely Jeff just touched the button there.
So what are you saying about the comparison of this to Full Metal Jacket?
I think there's a huge disparity between the two. I think this is, but you said it earlier. I think there's almost like a cinema verite feeling from Kubrick's work. Come on, he brings that sense of reality to a supernatural tale. He did it in The Shining. I rewatched The Shining recently. It looks like a piece of 70s cinema verite. If it's a clean print, it seems like it's voyeuristic. You know, it doesn't feel like, and I love that about it. I really like that about it. Everything feels lived in, but it's a supernatural tale, right? And I think he did the same with Full Metal Jacket from a visual standpoint. This feels like a movie. It feels like a movie. And when I said this is a simple tale, if you take away the framework of that particular war, this is more about good and evil it's almost like you could have a graphic novel about this, and I think that would be the best medium to tell the story. Actually, that the center, the middle of this movie is really like black and white, light and darkness. It's about these two things like just clashing. That's right in the middle of the movie, and I think that really works. If anything, it takes away from what could have come across as, look, I'll give you an example. There are some characters in this that highlight what I'm saying, like that light and dark, like it shows the divide, not just the socioeconomical divide between characters, but it's also some of the conversations. You know, you could see, and also the tribalistic quality of these two groups being divided, as in, you know, there's even like a bit with the music, like, okay, these are the greasers and these are the hippies. And it's like, and it's two groups. So there's that division within the group. And I'm not an American, but it's kind of, it's an important movie, actually. You said earlier to show people right now, it's like this division within the same group is, it's non-constructive. You know, they're called the United States of America for a reason. And yet, due to several factors, there's so much division within one place. And I think it's uttered by the main character in this movie as well. It's like, you know, we're at war with ourselves. And there's a lot of that. By the way, guys, I had no idea that Francesco Quinn, which he plays Ra, the leader of the junkies or whatever the druggies, is fucking Anthony Quinn's son.
Yeah. Yeah.
It looks like his father as well. I had no idea. And he's actually a pretty good fucking actor. Like, I love the performance. It's, you know, there's bits when
it's growly.
Yeah, it is. he died, man. He died in 2011. I was looking stuff. He had fucking a massive heart attack.
Well, massive heart attack. It just surprised me now about Corey Glover, because I was like looking at his IMDb list and I'm like, why is Corey Glover at WrestleMania? Why is Corey Glover appearing? Oh, because he's the lead singer of In Living Color. Who do the music God. For CM Punk, Cult of Personality. So he was actually at the last WrestleMania because he's the lead singer.
Jeff, so that you know, Ricky's a wrestling fan.
That's okay.
That's all right. It's not
he
all right.
He had just joined the band.
Yeah.
And basically had to turn around and tell his mum and the band that he was going away for like a month maybe to do a film, which ended up being 3 months.
Yeah.
And they had to cancel so many gigs.
It's okay though. Now he's on the greatest stage of them all, WrestleMania. Yeah. So it's all good.
I gotta tell you something. Like there was a moment, I was like, oh, "What the fuck?" When I was watching this movie, because I've seen it so many times, I watched it attentively, but I did reach out for my phone. All right, I did reach out for my phone. I was all related to this, and I went, "Who's this guy? Who's this guy?" It was one of the black dudes in the group, and I looked at him. I looked
Keith
him
David?
Up. I was like, no, fuck you, mate. No, what do you think? Come on. Reggie Johnson.
Reggie Johnson.
Wait a second. So I'm like, this guy, man, he reminds me of the limousine driver in Die Hard. Is that him? So I did a search on Google, just Reggie Johnson, Die Hard. And what comes up is not Reggie Johnson. It is Reggie Johnson, but it's Reginald Vell Johnson.
Vell Johnson.
Was the guy that plays the cop in Die Hard. I was like, oh, man, almost. So I took, that's it. That's a near miss.
And then, of course, I don't think you listed him in your list at the start, but the fact that Tony Todd is in this film.
I know. Tony
Todd,
being that
Forrest
big
Whitaker,
man.
Fucking everybody's in this.
Oh, there's a little bit of trivia about Forrest Whitaker. In the credits where he rolls down the hill, that was,
well, you mean the credits when the names come up?
Yeah.
Of the members of the platoon, right?
Yeah. So, no, we're at the beginning of the movie, when he falls down the hill and he rolls down, that wasn't intentional. And they kept it in the movie.
You're saying maybe he tripped over a ghost dog?
Ghost dog.
No. Whatever the fuck,
mate. You know, samurai step.
Christ.
But yeah.
You wanna
look, we've got Forest Whitaker, who's a big, you know, a big guy, but
was it a year before or a year later that he did Good Morning Vietnam?
Well, this is what I was going to say as well, because they, when they enter the base and you get to hear that, Good Morning Vietnam, and I was just like, oh man, this is like
in Platoon.
In Platoon,
Did anyone check if that was not?
I don't think it was Robin Williams.
No,
it wasn't Robin Williams, but it was the real voice.
I loved that movie when I was a kid. I loved that movie when that and Air America as well. Ricky, you mentioned Air America with is that Mel Gibson and
Mel Gibson and who's the other one?
Robert Downey Jr.
Yeah.
Oh, is it?
Yeah.
Oh well.
Yeah. I think I'm pretty sure.
Mr. Iron Man, Doctor Doom. Oh,
yeah, he fell out of favor, right? That's what happens to people that make too much money. Oh fuck!
Or crash your cars on drugs. Yeah.
Jeff, there was a picture of Robert Downey on going around the social media with him taking a selfie as he's reading something. And it's like a steal from... No, it's a steal. Like, he's taking a picture of himself.
Yeah.
But he's on the set of something.
He's on the set and of...
Yeah, he's wearing a fucking muscle suit.
Yeah.
That is not meant to look like a muscle suit. He's wearing the stuff that you put like under.
Yeah.
I'm thinking, what? You're getting paid fucking millions. Take some steroids, buddy.
Well, he can't redo that, isn't he? Yeah,
are you fucking kidding
he's
me?
Probably 60 years old now, so...
It doesn't matter. Have you seen fucking... Bring it up right now. Bring it up right now. Go take a look.
Are you talking about Ralph Fiennes?
Ralph Fiennes. Yeah. Look at fucking pictures of Fiennes.
Oh, yeah, I have seen
that. That's
crazy.
No
excuses, mate. No excuses.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And what's we up? Will continue talking about our male crushes.
I thought you weren't going to bring him in.
No, that wasn't him. That was me. That was me talking about my male crushes.
It did sound like Spader, right? It's just a dragging Spader.
How dare you? How dare you? That was my feminine side coming out. That is not James Spader. Okay. He is on holiday. Okay. He is not appearing this week.
Okay. I don't understand why you don't want to bring him out. Why?
Because I have too much...
You know, I would be curious later to hear a fucking one-star review of this movie.
No, because
there's got to be a piece of shit out there that did that.
There doesn't need to be a one-star review on this movie. This movie is so good. Like, I was going to say earlier that Oliver Stone, normally I don't like Oliver Stone films because I don't feel he's being genuine or he's like leaning too much on some sort of Americana that he's trying to push forward. One good example of that is JFK, because JFK is so like, look at the little man going against the big system. This one guy going against the big system. Doesn't matter how wrong he is, but the one guy going against the big system, which is, you know, the whole underdog story. This one, though, is so genuine. Everything about this film is authentic.
But this was a pushback, and this is from his own words, where he was upset with a false depiction of the Vietnam War and how war plays out, because he'd been there. Mm-hmm. And he was upset with like the John Wayne movie, Green Beret, and that kind of stuff from the 1960s. Yeah.
Before we started recording, Jeff and I were talking about how World War One films were dark and bleak.
Yeah.
Well, and Vietnam films were really dark and bleak. I mean, you just have to think about casualties of war. But there was this whole like roses after World War II, because they were trying to get seats back into the cinema. So it's like, look at this, like, great, you know, the Dam Busters, all of these films that, like, are trying to get seats back into the cinema. And this was a point, again, where it's like, we don't trust the government, we don't trust anything going on, because everybody's funding this and funding that war. So we're going to start depicting exactly what war is like for the grunts, for the people who die, not for the people who are like, yes, come join our war and things like that. And this was a great turning point, which is why I don't want to do a one-star review. I don't want to talk about that.
That's so, right. Look, we mentioned, Jeff, you're American, you served yourself. And I wanted to ask you a question. And the question is posed to you on the basis of something I thought about the other day. I served as well, by the way, because I'm 48 fucking tomorrow. So I'm not the oldest here, Stevie is. But... Well, Scott, sorry, but if I get a chance to remark the fact that you're 50 years old. Anyway.
Not quite yet.
Almost. Okay. But my generation, most parts of the world, I went through the draft as well. So you had to jump through hoops if you didn't want to serve. And I didn't want to serve at the time. Because, first of all, there was no conflict. It was wasted time, right? The time I served was a good time for me. You know, it was just burning days. That's all it was.
You're a worldwide traveler. Like, what nation did you serve with?
Italy. So
I'll probably have an Ethiopian joke for you at some point. But
at some point, yeah. Jesus Christ, you went back far, man. but it's fine. So it's I couldn't even fathom a scenario in which you get drafted and you have to go jump right into a conflict. And usually the draft kind of takes advantage of, you know, depleted socioeconomic areas.
Sure.
There's a lot of poor people. And this movie highlights that.
Yeah. I think even under the volunteer system, it still preys upon.
Yeah, it just causes a situation in which people would be drawn to it, of course.
Yeah, yeah. Free college.
Yeah, and the... I had to look it up yesterday, and it matched what I envisioned. So the draft was targeting people that were between 18 and 26, and I think this movie highlights that very well. Everything is even better than Full Metal Jacket. I think the dynamics between these people, because it's only like Full Metal Jacket feels like a longer movie. There's like a level of epic that this movie doesn't require. Like I said, it feels more like a simple story, but sometimes a simple story can hit much harder because it has a very defined beginning, middle, and end. And that's the way I feel about this movie. That's why it flew by. Like you know, like there's nothing worse than watching a movie and going, oh shit, that didn't land it. It didn't land the third act.
So what was your question specifically?
The question was, how did you feel about the government of the time or any government exploiting this? Exploiting the fact that, you know, even by proxy, people would be drawn to a coffin, basically.
I think that looking at that generation too, like, I think there was a lot of pressure put upon them, you know, by the young men in the 60s, that their fathers had been the ones that had fought in World War II. And I think that there was an ideal that existed with them of, and they'd been fed a lot of bullshit, you know, about the domino theory and stopping communism or whatever. But yeah, they had a perception of what war was that their fathers had put upon them. And I think there was a lot of pressure that was there that I think contributed to that, both on the draft front and on the volunteer front, I think.
What drew you to join the Navy?
It's a mixture of probably two things. I realized they weren't going to call my parents when I stopped going to my junior college classes. And I always thought submarines were cool. Yeah.
Sweet.
So
that's how I got into submarines. Yeah.
George does boot before signing up or after?
I joked with people when I was in the Navy that I saw Das Boot when I was like 12 years old and I thought it was cool. So, yeah.
In German.
I took the absolute wrong message from Das Boot. No. But Das Boot's a movie that's meant to keep you off of a submarine. But,
absolutely.
Yeah. One thing that I also want to say about this movie is that there's something about this one, because it is based on the younger generation being drafted into the Vietnam War, which previous to this film, now this film got a little bit of pushback because a lot of people said, oh, it's not, we've already got Apocalypse Now. We've already got Deer Hunter. Why do we need another one? And so it got a lot of pushback because of that. But if you look at Apocalypse Now, it's sort of like an Alice in Wonderland fairy tale of what Vietnam was. So it's sort of like it has a story arc. But that's...
Well, Apocalypse Now truly feels like it's based on a novel.
Yeah.
This movie feels like it's based on somebody's account of a...
Yeah.
Right?
And Deer Hunter, we're talking about how long Full Metal Jacket feels like. Deer Hunter is so long. It's 3 hours.
It feels like a story told by Christopher Walken.
But not only that, it's almost generational. Like, there's so many different elements to Deer Hunter that it's almost generational.
But that Deer Hunter, from a structural point, when it comes down to this medium to film, Deer Hunter is akin to Paris, Texas.
Yeah.
If you stay with it, you'll be rewarded at the end.
No, do not get me wrong. I felt the same when I read that. Platoon got a lot of pushback because people were saying that, oh, there's Apocalypse Now and Deer Hunter, why do we need another one? I felt the same way. When you said, let's do Platoon, I'm like, oh, but it's not Deer Hunter. Oh, but it's not as fun as Apocalypse Now. But rewatching it now, I'm like, it's probably just as important, if not even more, because it's being told.
Platoon.
Because it's being told from that younger generation that was forced to feel this war. And that was a large majority because they had
Jeff. We lost Jeff.
No, we haven't lost him.
No, I'm here.
Is he getting undressed? Are you getting changed, Jeff? Is that why you cut off the camera?
Should I start that line again?
Yeah,
can we watch Jeff getting undressed? Put the camera on, Jeff.
Till I start that line again.
Because I think you were going very well, Aaron.
I thought I was. But you know what? No, you were doing really well. Let's go back to the comedy. You know when he fell over at the start? Wasn't that funny? It reminded me of Hot Shots.
Is the happy birthday banner strategically placed behind you?
Yeah, it is.
Something that you said earlier that I thought was kind of tied to your question too. I do feel like Platoon, compared to other war movies, I feel like it doesn't go into it as much as I wanted to, but the various conflicts within the same demographic, where these guys are all grunts, these guys are all draftees, yet they still find ways to create tribalism. Yeah. Especially with I feel like there's a lot more that could have been said with the African American soldiers. I wanted more there. But that's like a very strong divide. But even then, how they kind of branch out into their own groups amongst themselves, where there's some of them that are part of the pot smoking group, and there's some of them that aren't, you know. Mm. And I think too, the divide between the officers and the enlisted is another one, between Captain Wolf and the guys, you know, it's an important thing that's brought out.
Well, what I took out of that was alcohol brings people together and so do drugs.
But what you were saying, Jeff, is totally true, because you have that moment where they're listening to White Rabbit by Jefferson Starship, I think.
No, Jeff is an airplane, you maniac.
One pill makes you larger, and one pill makes you small. And the ones that mother gives you don't do.
It's airplane, I think, yeah.
One of the few of the others. Anyway,
what the fuck?
Okay. But they're listening to what one of them regards to as, oh, this is just cracker music, and it's just a country song of the time.
That conversation was between the greaser. Yeah.
What was interesting about that scene was, as much as Oliver Stone was and wasn't promoting the use of marijuana in that scene, was that they end up dancing close together and having a really good time and being in close quarters, whereas the guys who are just drinking are as far away from each other as possible.
Good point.
But the previous point I was talking about.
Before you move away from this, there's a very endearing sequence in that. Yeah. But in that entire bonding thing in the drug den, let's say, right? The junkie, the burners headquarters, let's call it. There's one bit when they all come together, and it's really, it warmed my heart, man, because it reminded me of that period of your life in which, you know, you male bonding becomes it's a strengthening part of your life, right? And I think the song that comes on is by Smokey Robinson and The Miracle, and it's the track of my tears.
Ooh,
Yeah.
That's when they're all come together, and it's beautifully shot. It's just very simple, but it's beautifully shot.
Yeah.
Before that, in the same environment, I needed to rewatch Platoon to because I was thinking about it in the shower today. I thought there's possibly two actors in my world, all right, which is shared with your world, guys. That's why we have this podcast, including you, Jeff. You're guesting for a reason. There are two actors of different generations that have this very particular energy that is non-defined, like it's all like weird energy. Let's call it weird energy because that's the easiest way for me to label it. It's Michael Shannon and Willem Dafoe.
Yeah,
I put them in the same box. There's like, that's why they can play a villainous role or a righteous role flawlessly, because they bring that energy to every role. Like, yeah, we've seen Dafoe as the hero here. What is it, a year before, a year later, he was playing Bobby Peru.
Fucking. It was a year before.
Yeah, but yeah, he was also in Vietnam, right? That character also had this dark edge that came from, you know, from coming back from a war. For all you know, Willem Dafoe survived his death in Platoon and came back as Bobby Peru. The point of the matter is, the music in this as well, it's a shame because it's overshadowed by one tune we said at the beginning, which is it Adagio for Strings? Is that what it's called?
Yeah.
So, like, I actually always thought it was a Morricone tune for some reason.
No. Samuel Barber wrote it in the 30s. What I found really weird about it is actually this was Adagio for Strings was the thing that actually made me slightly go, oh, we're doing Platoon.
Why?
Because there's something, again, it's my preconception.
It's a very powerful piece of music. Dude.
And it's my prejudice that Oliver Stone kind of goes for the easy, like, emotional things. So, you know, like World Trade Center as well is a good example of that, where you can't get that film wrong. There is no way you can get that film wrong because you're hitting certain emotional points. Even
it's very heavy-handed.
Yes. And even with this film, Adagio for Strings was used for several presidential funerals. It's already a song.
Really? Post this movie or before?
No, before this movie.
Before.
So it's already cliched by the time this movie comes out. You already know that when you hear this music, it opens with this music, which means
I always associate that tune with Platoon, though.
Exactly. Now you
that can't be the mark of a bad.
No. I'm saying that now you do, but at the time when it was released, it was technically already a very well-known song to do with death and funerals.
Gotcha.
So you're opening a film, all these young people coming off the plane, ready to start their tour, and you're hearing a funeral song.
John McKinley. I am a huge fan. Everywhere he pops up. Like, obviously, Scrubs, you know, introduced this to Dr. Cox. You know, such a caricature of, you know, that type of archetype, and it's immortal.
He has one of the most iconic lines in Office Space, too. He has the...
Absolutely.
What is it that you say that you do here? That's part of the boss.
But he also, wherever he appears as a character actor, he's memorable. Like, I remember him in an episode of Frasier, in which he pops up as one of the guys that comes to fix Frasier's toilet. And it turns out that he's a bully from their high school days, and he's phenomenal. Like, he's always memorable. But if you have not seen it, if you like The Evil Dead, if you like horror and you like comedy, you cannot miss a show called Stand Against Evil. It ran for 3 seasons. It stars John McKinley as the central character of it, and it's phenomenal. Again, just Google it. Google it now, guys. I have the 3 seasons, and you need to watch it. None of you have seen this.
I've already watched it.
All right, you watched
it. It's on Amazon.
All right.
Yeah.
All right. Completely on a complete blind spot. I appreciate that.
It's phenomenal. Stand Against Evil. It's funny as hell. It's very akin to Evil Dead. It really is. I think it's, you know. Guys, we are on the 55-minute mark. I think it's time to for the liberations, because the reason, what are we going to do? What are we going to do? We're going to throw factoids at each other? Like,
yeah, is there anything? I mean, there's a lot more. There's a lot more to this film.
Of course there's a lot more.
And I could sit here talking about the dichotomy of Vietnam Wars and how it gets represented on the screen during this film and many other films. But it comes down to this. If you haven't seen this film and you are strong-willed and have a strong stomach, go just sit yourself down for 2 hours. Just sit down, don't have your phone anywhere near you, and just experience this film. Because there was a time where nobody understood what it was like to be in the middle of action. And this is a perfect, perfect film to show you what it's like.
I'm just going to mention the fact that this is still rated as one of the 100 great movies of all time by the American Institute of Film. So if you haven't seen it, see it. I hold my hand up and say that this has been a regular watch for me over the years. It's a very well-structured movie. It's perfectly played out. It shows you the horror of war. It's not something which is taken lightly, and you need to remember these things sometimes.
Absolutely. I think any young man should watch this movie.
Yeah.
Jeff?
Yeah, this would be the movie that, like, you know, you should make your kid watch before they walk down to the recruiting station.
Yeah.
You sure about this?
Because also, there's, like, we haven't really talked about the village scene. Which is fine. We don't need to talk about the village scene.
No, we don't.
I can't think of any other movie that has, like, kind of, this is kind of like a paraphrasing of, like, the My Lai Massacre, basically, right? You know, like that type of moment.
I would say
Casualties of War.
Casualties of War.
Okay.
Yeah.
Oh, it's almost a shame because you remember the movie because of that sequence.
Yeah.
More than anything.
But with the village scene, there's a lot of elements about the village scene where even Sally turned around to me and said, I don't understand where this has come from. And it's actually a lot more shocking because of it. This has only come from the fact that the previous scene where they found a dead colleague. And I was like, yes, that's the point. The point is that they're doing standard procedures. They're doing standard coverage. And then all of a sudden, out of nowhere, their humanity just leaves them.
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I, you know, Jeff mentioned that Charlie Sheen's acting is not great in this. You know, that's why he's overshadowed by everybody else in it. But there's that sequence in which I wish we had a better actor for that. There's the spiraling out. Actually, yeah. I can't help myself but putting Cage in that.
Well,
you know, in the moment in which he spirals, he starts going crazy and starts shooting
the
guy at his
feet.
Making
the guy dance.
Yeah. And I thought his acting almost took me out of that, because that's a very powerful sequence.
It's a powerful sequence.
And someone
sequence.
Like Cage, believe it or not, would have done that.
Yeah.
Would have done that better.
But the scene where
laughing at the thought of Nicolas Cage.
Yeah, well. But he can do crazy.
Another Nicolas Cage freak out, you know, just never happened.
Yeah, well.
However, there's two scenes where I'll give Charlie Sheen for this film. First of all, I hated the narration, so let's put that to one side.
Yeah, and it's so akin to Apocalypse Now.
Exactly.
Voiceover.
But saying that, there was the bit where he talks about his background, and it comes up again when they're cleaning the latrines. So they didn't even need that bit where they could have just had a montage. But I don't know who Oliver Stone was getting advice from. He was out of his mind during this film. There was even talk that he went up to the editor and said, where's this scene? I want to, you've cut this scene out. And there was no scene. He hadn't filmed
never
it.
Shot.
He
hadn't even filmed
never
it.
Shot it. Yeah. He was out of his mind during this film. But anyway, I was going to say there's two scenes that I really rate Charlie Sheen for in this film. The first one is where he's sat and he's in his first operation that they're doing, where he's just sat there and they've all fallen asleep and he's woke up again.
The ant sequence.
The end sequence.
I like that one.
That's good. But the one where it's raining, they've all fallen asleep.
He's woken up again. He's in the shroud.
And he's in the shrouded and he doesn't know what to do. But wait a moment.
The guy that kept accusing him, Reggie Johnson's character, he's the one that fucking fell asleep.
He's the one that fucked up.
He's the one that fucked up and keeps accusing him. Like, it's, man, that was tense. Like, Jeff was talking about the tension in this
movie.
But remember, it's palpable. Like, you
remember, excuses are like assholes, Taylor. Everybody's got one. So,
man, I want to watch another movie with fucking Barringer and Defoe going at each other.
It's like
in Casualties of War, we got that conflict. The movie was about just the two of them. Yeah. You know, and that's what Casualties of War is, because it's a piece for Sean Penn, it's a vehicle for Sean Penn and for Michael J. Fox.
Yeah.
In this movie, it's more of an ensemble, right? It's an ensemble piece, but it's so powerful. The entire sequence, right? Even when you see, because it's the first time, I forget, but it's the first time I see Defoe in a heroic kind of righteous role to this extent.
Yeah,
the moment he goes. When he shows up, and it's, you'll believe it. You'll believe it, man. That piece of acting is, there's other shit going on in the house that I had to do, whatever. I was in the movie. That's why I love this medium. Like, in that sequence, I could have had an explosion going next to me, and I would have ignored it, you know?
You know, Defoe was violently ill during the film of this movie because he drank some water. There was a dead...
Pig, wasn't it? A dead pig, up the street.
By the water source. Yeah,
24 hours where they really thought he wasn't going to do it.
Fuck.
Yeah. Oliver Stone probably loved that. He's doing it on purpose! Get him out of the drawer! But the second scene where I'd say that Charlie Sheen really proved himself in this movie was the bit where Johnny Depp's character gets shot. And he drags him over to the medic. And that was very, very touching, the way he was just like, you're going to be okay, man. He's going to look at you. You're going to wake up, at, you know. And
But he sees, and I like that as well, because it kind of, I don't know, brings a sense of plausibility to it. He witnesses Whitaker. It's like he's learning different things about traits that you would want as a man, right? And he's... I think that's what the movie was trying to tell us. Like how he's, this is formative. This is a formative experience, and he's learning from different members of his platoon, right? Because he sees Whitaker doing it first, and he's witnessing this. Like, my God, all of a sudden the divide between characters doesn't matter. None of this matters. You know, it's just we are in the same situation, so it doesn't matter where you're from, what your background is. It doesn't fucking matter. The tension in this movie is highlighted when that's taken away, and there's a sense of normality, all of a sudden this antagonistic kind of attitude towards one another comes back. But when it's down and dirty and there's danger, everybody's, you know, in tune. It's not.
You say that, Umbra, and I think that's one of the things that's actually one of the most beautiful parts of military service, honestly, is that trauma bonding that happens.
Oh, fuck yeah.
You know, I always say that, like, after, you know, people ask me, you know, like, oh, what was the best part about being in the military or something? It's like, it's the fact that you form bonds with people across race and socioeconomic and religious and, you know, gender or whatever. Like, all that stuff just fucking goes away, you know, when you're stuck in a difficult situation and you put that all aside and you work together and you look back on it, you know.
I think it's something hard to comprehend for someone that perhaps due to life experience or the young, they haven't had that. But it's like you said, it's trauma bonding. Like, it truly doesn't, I think it goes beyond the comprehension of some people. You may walk away and still walk away with a narrow-minded view of the world, but when you address that person that you have that bond with, all of that fucking melts away and it doesn't exist.
I think the people that come away from the military without that, like, haven't been paying attention, you know, and missed one of the most important parts about being in the military, honestly.
Or it's just stolen valor and they haven't seen enough shit, to be honest.
Not only have you got the trauma bonding, but you've also got such a short time because they had the 365-day cycle, like once you've done a year out on tour, you get to go home. And that is the point. There's that whole scene where they're discussing how many days you got left, or like, oh, we now count up rather than down because it's easier that way. And just knowing that all of these young men were just being shoved out with barely any training and just being told you're in it now. And you do learn on the job. You learn on the job. You learn in the atmosphere. It is trauma bonding. But you know what? In 100 days, you might not even see that guy again because either they're dead or they've gone home and they're not coming back.
Because of the heaviness of, you know, the topical heaviness of this movie. And, you know, it's not just its theme, but it's its tone as well. Whatever comedy hits, it hits so fucking hard. Even, and it's silly. It's silly. You have Ryan Stiles falling backwards, going, and falling down, like in a slapstick kind of way in our shots. And it doesn't fucking, if anything, you roll your eyes. But it happens in this one. You have Charlie Sheen just falling back right after he's lifted up by two members of the platoon. And he's in the center of the frame and he falls backwards in a comedic manner. And it's fucking funny. It's funny because it's the first time you laughed for 40 minutes. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like it's, there's another funny bit later on. Do you remember any of the comedy beats in this?
I'll be honest. There's
three or four. Like,
the fallback one was super funny. Maybe the bit where he's got in like trench foot and he's just like, you know, go on then, court martial me. I don't care. Yeah.
Spray on his feet,
yeah, which I didn't know was a thing, by the way, that could be bad, but it was probably DDT was still a thing that it used to put in. Was it called DDT? The chemical compound that's really harmful to humans.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, that's DMT.
No. Oh, you just summoned Joe Rogan. Holy shit. Look for that, Jamie. towards the end of this movie, right at the end, John McKinley takes the cake.
Oh, yeah.
He's the one that has been told that he has to stay an extra year. And the look on his face, as much as it's tragicomic, right?
And you know what?
That's what he deserves, though.
Yeah,
Butt shark.
He tries to get out when he goes to Baron Just Carter and he goes,
and they have that conversation. I'm on my leave, man.
Man, I hated Barringer even more. Man, he's so fucking good in this.
Yeah.
Tom Berenger is so good at this. You know who it reminded me of? Fucking Frank Sinatra. In the 60s, he played this character, the old god. And he if there was a Sinatra biopic, he would have smashed it. Yeah. He would have smashed it. And actually, you have Francesco Queen as well in this. You know, you could have had the Dean Martin, Queen, all these fucking characters of that period in one movie, like Orbit, you could have had a Rat Pack movie and he would have slammed it. But
But then if you had like the Rat Pack version of Platoon, it would have been a very different
film.
No, not
a Platoon. I'm talking about a Rat Pack movie.
Yeah.
With Barringer
playing the Rat Pack.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
I just have a Sinatra out in Vietnam.
He was in a ton of propaganda.
My martini is drier than your wife. So I'm saying fill him up.
Sammy Davis Jr. is the black guy.
There you go. Yeah, no, forget that. That's not what I'm saying. I'm saying they should have made, which by the way, I think in the late 90s, so 10 years later, there was a Rat Pack movie that came out. Not enough star power went into it. You know, and they should do it at some point properly because enough time has passed. But it's, I don't know. I think Berenger is, man, he's, when I said he was hypnotic in this, it leaves a memory burn, dude. His performance is when he's basically telling them indirectly, I can take all five of you right now, and they know it. Nobody makes a move. They were talking about, you know, the situation getting to a point in which someone is implying we need to kill him, and then you know Charlie Sheen's character in a non-believable manner goes through with it. He's the one that takes him out at the end, right? And he deserves it. So it's kind of brushed over almost. But that sequence is powerful. When the movie turns almost into a horror movie, like Jeff said earlier. There's a sense of threat in there. You know, and the sequence carries it on. Like you're waiting for some shit to go down. It doesn't happen. It doesn't have to happen. And I even love the way he stumbles outside of that place.
I was going to say, like, even the moment towards the end with Berenger, he becomes like, it comes out of nowhere because you're watching all of this awfulness go on, and then all of a sudden Charlie Sheen's character, Berenger's character, come together, and
yeah, he's portrayed like a demon, right? Red eyes and everything, they're shot.
Yeah, that was so almost like...
Yeah, but they used the wrong lens, dude. That's what took me out of the movie. At the beginning of this podcast, I was saying there's a sequence in particular, from a visual standpoint, was the wrong move. It's the lens. There's a moment in which Charlie Sheen is throwing his hands forward. Do you remember the shot?
Yeah, that's the shot you're talking about.
And it cuts between Yeah, it cuts from him to Berenger, who's portrayed like a demon.
Yeah.
Red eyes and all. I think, again, that's the heavy-handed nature of this movie that Jeff talked about earlier, that you talked about earlier. It's not needed. And I even the use of that lens, it's like it's way too wide. You're making it quirky. I don't know what to feel. I don't know what to fucking feel now.
But I think that was the intent. Not the Charlie Sheen bit, not this bit, but the Berenger bit. He looks, you can't, he's possessed. He feels the killing, he's a demon.
Yeah,
but he's also got the, you know, the killing vibe, the taste. He's just going around, even people who are like already down and just crawling away, he's absolutely masquerading.
Look, it's also implied that he served several times, like five or six cycles, right?
Yeah.
One thing about that scene where Taylor actually frags him that I thought was very telling of Berenger's character of Sergeant Barnes is that even up until the very end, like he's not groveling. It's not like it's been like some sort of like facade that like he's put on or something. So even that moment, like when he's looking at death, he's still ordering him to like call a medic, you know, and he doesn't transition into like some sniveling guy that, you know, I thought that was like a very telling part of Sergeant Barnes' character.
Yeah.
Where it's like, it's not a facade. It's not a joke. This guy is fucking broken.
Yeah.
Isn't it?
Yeah. And the good thing
still
is,
acting, true believer, you know? He's still acting.
Yes. Yeah.
Berenger.
It picks up the gun that Sheen picks up is a Type 56. It's a Chinese. Everybody kind of mistakes it as an AK-47, but it's not. It's a Chinese branded Norioki.
We have entered the realm of the podcast where Steve is going to let us know about, I'm sure, the RPG as well as a few.
I just wanted to. This is a distinctive type, purely on the basis that Barnes is shot with a VC gun. Both William Dafoe and Tom Berenger use a Colt model 6.53, which wasn't used in the Vietnam War.
Unacceptable.
Both those guns are very distinctive because of the barrel, so you can see it straight away. But for the most part, everybody else is using the M16 or the M16A1s, which are the standard. But everything is pretty much on spec.
Yes.
The M60 machine gun does turn up, which is the same one which is used in Rambo and Hot Shots Part 2.
Have you read the book The Gun?
No, I haven't.
Dude, you need to look into that.
Okay.
It's a book. It's about the history. It's basically about, in 1947, there were two weapons that the Soviet Union designed that, you know, shaped American foreign policy, one of which was, we focused more on, and which was the hydrogen bomb. And the other one was the AK-47, and which one of those two wound up being more destabilizing? And it was the AK-47.
The AK-47, so,
The AK-47 is basically being used because it Kalashnikov himself, when he created the gun, it's just an amazing piece because it can be used in pretty much every single. It just works.
The M16 was a weapon that was designed for a war that never happened.
Yeah,
and it wound up being where the AK-47 was the far superior rifle in Vietnam.
That's it.
Are we talking about the C.J. Shivers 2010 novel?
Yep.
The gun,
and it's also, it goes into like the history of like automatic weapons in general between, like, you know, Vickers and John Browning and those guys, and like their mindset and designing stuff like that. Where their mindset, you know, like John Browning's, you know, mindset was like, hey, if I can make a gun that can lay down 10 times as much lead, then we'd only have to use 1/10 of the amount of soldiers.
Yeah.
That was really where their head was at, as opposed to just, you know, a meat fucking grinder. What it wound up being.
Browning M2 HB, the heavy machine gun, is used on the personnel carriers in this. What?
I'm sorry. I don't even mean to feed this.
No, you brought the Browning.
Read the book, and I was the gun. Just like, you'll oh love my God. It. It's
yeah.
so good.
Yeah.
Let me describe Umbar's position right now. He is hunched over with his hand right on his forehead. He does have a slight smirk on his face, but he's looking at the time being like, my God, I've got a whole day of drinking ahead of me. My goodness.
With him. I've got a whole day of drinking with him.
Umbar, you invited an American on.
This shit stops for you. It stops for the listeners. And I have to be with him after.
Hey.
I love you, buddy.
What? I love you too. Yeah. Best way you're going to be my best man. That's kind of scary in itself.
Bring some fucking guns to the wedding. Yeah. Ah, you like them so much. Like,
no,
relax. Guns. It's okay.
No guns.
Now, at least I've got a book that I can now buy Steve for his birthday in August. He turns 50.
Thank you.
I want to read as well now. Yeah. Jeff, I've got to ask you a personal question. I'll cut out of the show if you don't feel comfortable in answering this. I need to understand how deep this goes at a social level in the States. So, no judgment. Have you got any weapons in the house?
Yeah.
So, this is a fucking long pause, dude. How many? How many?
I have a few. I like guns for...
Look at Steve's face. Steve's face. Coming to your house, man. Steve's coming to your house.
I'm not an ammo sexual. You know, like
a what?
I like gun. People in America were like,
"What did you say?"
An ammo sexual.
Your entire personality is devoted to like
guns
and
stuff. Do you have to keep the weapon and the ammo in separate parts of the house?
No,
is that a thing?
No. It's just locked.
It's not a thing.
You got to keep it locked up. But that's
It locked up.
Okay.
But the only reason I know so much about guns is because my father. So my father was into military. We had guns at home.
Yeah,
that's it.
I like guns mostly for the historical stuff.
Yeah,
that's really what it is.
Pretty much the same for me. Where we had Boer War muskets and various other bits and pieces hanging around.
Like Nintendo.
It all started with Duck Hunt. Duck Hunt. Sorry.
I really think we all like Nintendo. We're of a similar age line here.
I'm sorry.
Oh my God.
It's not your fault.
Oh my God.
Do this to me, man.
It's not your fault.
Don't do this to me, man.
All right, ratings time. Let's go. Okay.
Just
someone's
going to
get drunk.
Yeah, we're done with.
Ratings. Oh, shit. Come on. I've got to go. I've got to do stuff.
Yeah, come on. Ratings time. Let's go.
Who wants to go first? Our guest should go first. You don't know. We start a tradition. I'm going to ask you to do something. Get a pencil or a pen. All of you.
I got my digital one this time.
Only decimal points allowed are half, so
3.5.
Otherwise it's fucking fuck you, okay? That's what it is. So 0.5, yes, but that's as far as we go. From 1 to 10.
Fine.
And also start thinking about what it is. Jeff, you listen to the show enough, you know what I'm talking about.
Oh, we did. Well, we're going to show it.
Oh, we're going to put
it down.
Okay.
It's an 8. Oh, you got
8.5. You're like almost unanimous. Yeah.
8.
No kidding.
And what's yours? What's yours, Jeff?
8.
8. 8 out of 10.
So we got 2 8s and 2 8.5s.
Yeah.
That's
There's division reasonable. In this group as well.
No.
Yeah, it's pretty minor, though, I mean.
Something tells me that we are into the same things as well, Ricky.
Yeah.
All right.
I think if you put it all together, it's an average of like what, like 8.125 or something?
Yeah.
Divided up. Yeah. Yeah. So I feel like it's an important movie. It's a little heavy handed in some of its imagery. And I guess like what you were talking about, Umbar, some of the cinematography is a little heavy handed. But I think it's an important movie that everybody should see. It's a good one of the better anti-war movies that's out there. I give it 8 out of 10 shotgun bong loads.
Nice.
Nice.
All right, Steve.
Okay, I'm going to give it an 8 out of 10 again. And the reason why I'm giving it this an 8 out of 10 is pretty much what we're unanimously going to say, but it is a little bit heavy-handed. The movie itself is a great anti-war movie. It's so on the nose in some scenes, and sometimes it's a little bit difficult to watch. Let's just say that for that one village segment. Let's just... but I'm going to give it 8 crushed cans which have been torn apart
by Kevin Dillon.
By Kevin Dillon.
And taking a bite out of it.
That's you bastard. That's a good one. That's a good one. Good one.
Umba, how about you?
I loved this movie when I was younger, and for different reasons. I think it had that kind of camaraderie kind of feeling of the company. Like, even if it's a completely different topic, I'll put Stand By Me in the same box. There was this sense of, when I was, you know, a tween, watching this, what the fuck do I know about war? But it was like about, yeah, it's us against them. And it wasn't like one army against the other, but it was, it's this group against that group. And we're in the same, under the same. So I grew up in that tribalistic environment in which that sense of division unified you with your peers. Because you had this common goal. We like this and you like that. So, you know, it was that divide. And that, I still live in a very tribalistic world. You know, I'm attuned to people that wear a certain thing or wear black or listen to a particular type of music. Or we all are. We all have that sense of kinship, you know. And if you're not into the things that we're into, yeah, I just as you grow old, you stop hanging out with those people because that energy cannot be applied with the same strength and fervor. It's just, it goes away. So you don't immerse yourself in that conflict anymore. It doesn't take center stage. But it drove me when I was young. So I like we said earlier, there's several reasons why a young person, and I'm sorry to say that, but most likely a man actually, or a boy, is probably more likely to have to watch this, I think. It's almost compulsory. And when I say that, it's because the movie is targeted at men, young men, probably as well. It was targeting young men, and it still is. But it is an 8.5.
A rite of passage.
It's a rite of passage. That's it. Rite of passage, you know. And by modern standards, that's as well. This is toxic. This movie's toxic. I don't give a fuck, okay? I really don't care. That's fair. I don't care that you're right or wrong. It's what it meant to me. You know, you're most probably right by modern social standards. You're very right, but that's got nothing to do with it. It's our personal experience with this movie, and all of that led me to give this movie an 8.5, and that's pretty high praise. You know, on this podcast, we rated movies like Hot Shots Part II at 7.5, Ricky.
Yes, I did.
How? I told you. I'm gonna throw this back at him every episode. Every episode, you'll be reminded of that.
It's because I'll watch it again, and we all know that.
So this movie, you're saying Platoon is slightly better than Hot Shots Part
II? No. I'm just taking the piss out
of it. It's a whole point.
I gave Hot Shots Part II a 4.5, not a fucking 7.5. But anyway, it's 8.5, and it's 8.5 booby-trapped map-containing boxes.
Yeah,
entire sequence. Holy shit!
Oh my god!
The tension. It's a shame that it's edited that way because they keep cutting to something else.
Yeah,
but as he goes through, he raffles through the boxes. Like it's like, yeah, no, it's you think maybe something's wrong here, maybe something's gonna happen, and then he just lifts the entire thing. Boom! Anyway, so that's my rating.
Nice.
Ricky.
Okay, well, I am going to stick with what I said earlier. This movie is just, it's on a different level to most war films. It's a film that's hard to watch. It's a film that depicts war very genuinely. It is an authentic film. I wouldn't recommend myself to watch it again in the near future, but I will show it to my children when they become of a certain age, because I think it's a very important film. So I'm giving this an 8.5 Tom Berenger's scarred up face that took 3 hours to apply most days.
Oh, there's a factoid in the you gender factoid in the rating. Steve, take note.
It's all right.
Take note. Yeah. Oh, no, don't take note. Please don't take note.
Please don't take note.
And on that note, this was Umba.
This is Ricky.
This is Steve.
I'm Jeff.
Bye!
Bye!